You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is sponsored by Nadex. Imagine if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front. That way, you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Poor Ulysses S. Grant. You lead a million-man army and win the war that preserves the Union and frees the slaves, then the American people elect you president not once but twice, and still you go down in history remembered as a drunkard, a brute, a financial failure, and an incompetent president who presided over one of the most corrupt administrations in history. So much so that an aggregate of historical rankings of U.S. presidents puts Grant at number 36. Just a reminder, we've only had 45 presidents. Seems like a pretty shabby way to treat a war hero, especially when you consider that the United States of America might not even exist today if it hadn't been for Ulysses Grant. Honestly, what's a guy got to do to get a little respect? Well, my guest today, Ron Chernow, says Ulysses S. Grant's life has all too often been either misunderstood or mischaracterized, and these stereotypes don't even come close to capturing the real man and his accomplishments. Now the award-winning historian is on a mission to rehabilitate the 18th president with a masterful new biography titled Grant. One of America's most venerated historians, Chernow has earned accolades and acclaim as a biographer of giants in U.S. history, from titans of industry like J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller to founding fathers Alexander Hamilton and George Washington. In 2011, he won the Pulitzer Prize and American History Book Prize for his book Washington, A Life. He's also the recipient of the National Book Award for The House of Morgan, An American Banking Dynasty, and The Rise of Modern Finance. His biographies of John D. Rockefeller Sr. and Alexander Hamilton were both nominated for National Book Critics Circle Awards, while the latter was also turned into the hit Broadway musical Hamilton. The recipient of the 2015 National Humanities Medal, Ron Chernow has just completed his 7th book, an epic work on the life of Ulysses S. Grant. And today he joins me to separate fact from fiction surrounding the much-maligned general and president. He shares what he's learned about Grant's drinking and whether it was as bad as it's been portrayed. He discusses Grant's early failures in life, his meteoric rise through the ranks during the Civil War, and how Grant struggled with his own personal Civil War at home. He makes the case for General Grant as a brilliant military strategist and argues that he deserves more credit for holding the Union together and ensuring that emancipation didn't become an empty promise. We discuss how Grant later went broke when he trusted his fortune to the Bernie Madoff of his day, and how none other than Mark Twain helped the former president dig himself out of debt so he wouldn't leave his family destitute when he finally died of agonizing throat cancer. Plus, Ron gives his review of Grant's own autobiography, weighs in on the Confederate statue controversy, and more, coming up with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Ron Chernow in just a moment. Ron Chernow is one of America's most respected historians, the recipient of the 2015 National Humanities Medal. He's authored 7 books, including his first book, The House of Morgan, which won the National Book Award, Washington, A Life, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography, and Alexander Hamilton, which inspired the Broadway musical and earned Rob Chernow an American History Book Prize. Now he's followed those up with his epic book titled Grant, which Newsday hailed as the definitive biography of Ulysses S. Grant, and the New York Times is calling a major event. Ron Chernow, thanks for coming on the podcast, and congratulations on Grant.
Thank you so much. It's been very gratifying. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, when I think of Grant and Lee, it always struck me as ironic that the leader of the rebel army went on to this semi-distinguished retirement as the president of Washington College, now Washington and Lee, and was regarded as this gentleman and sort of this elder statesman in the South, while the general who won the war and became the president of the United States went broke and sort of went down in history as this sad, incompetent drunk in the popular imagination. Was part of your goal to rehabilitate Grant's reputation?
Absolutely. You know, I think that there's a contrarian streak in my nature that I like to take the received wisdom and turn it upside down. And that was certainly one of the ironies that was most on my mind, that the South lost the Civil War, as we all know, and yet Lee was lionized as the great general. And Grant, who to my mind was infinitely the superior general, was denigrated. You know, during the war, Grant actually captures 3 Confederate armies. He captures the Confederate army at Fort Donelson in Tennessee in 1862, Vicksburg in Mississippi in 1863, and most famously Robert E. Lee's own army at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865. Robert E. Lee never captured a single Union army. So why is it that there are all these monuments to Robert E. Lee rather than to Ulysses S. Grant?
Yeah, it really gives lie to this idea that the victors get to write the history books, doesn't it?
Well, in many ways, you know, the North won the war and lost the peace. And kind of a major theme of the book is the extent to which the South, after the Civil War, was able to roll back many of the gains that the North had achieved, particularly in terms of trying to achieve a fully biracial society in the U.S. for the first time.
Now, the popular caricature of Grant today is that he was this bumbling drunkard getting into, the denigration of poor Ulysses Grant. Was Grant's alcoholism really as bad as it's portrayed?
Well, you know, it's funny, Ben, because when I started doing the book, my friend Harold Holzer, who's a great Lincoln scholar, said, you know, Ron, it would be nice to settle once and for all the Grant and drinking controversy, which I like to think that I have. What I discovered was, I think one thing that has mystified historians for 150 years is that a lot of people who worked very closely with Grant said, you know, I worked with him for weeks or months. I never saw him touch a drop of liquor. All of these stories are invented. But what I discovered was that Grant was an alcoholic. I say that, one, because by his own admission, he couldn't take just one glass. He would then have to drink more. And two, it would trigger off a personality change. And one reason that there was, you know, one group of people who saw him drunk and other people, you know, who never did, was that he was a periodic or episodic binge drinker. He could go for 2 or 3 months without taking a glass of alcohol. And then he would go on a bender. And what I found was that there was an amazingly consistent pattern. He never drank on the eve of a battle or during a battle. But after battle, when the pressure was off, he would travel to a side town where he could not be seen by his soldiers or officers. And then he would have a 2 or 3 day drunk. And according to William Tecumseh Sherman, he was then able to snap back and, as Sherman said, be fresh as a rose when it was over.
So then Grant was a functioning alcoholic, or were there moments when his drinking affected his judgment or performance or possibly cost soldiers' lives?
That's a wonderful question because, you know, as part of my research, I can't tell you how many friends I spoke to, you know, who were in AA, and they all had the same reaction. Grant was what we call in AA a high-functioning alcoholic. It did not affect his performance. He could almost schedule these binges. And so it's a fascinating story. I also tell the story that when he became Brigadier General, he hired as his chief of staff a young lawyer from his town of Galena, Illinois, John Rawlins. And Rawlins took the job on the condition that if Grant touched a drop of liquor during the war, that he, Rawlins, would quit. Anyway, a central part of my narrative is what happened between these two men because Grant fell off the wagon many times. Rawlins privately chastised him while publicly reassuring President Lincoln and others that there was no problem. The reason he did that was that he came to believe that the fate of the Union cause rested on the shoulders of Grant, that there was no other general. That there was no other general who was of Grant's caliber.
Now, what was Ulysses Grant's upbringing like?
He grew up in he was born in 1822. He grew up in the southwestern corner of Ohio, just outside of what's Cincinnati today. This was a rural area. And I think the location where he grew up is very important to the story because he was just born paces from the Ohio River, which separated slave-owning Kentucky from free Ohio.
Yeah.
And so this is a childhood spent, you know, kind of straddling the North-South divide recently. And I think that it's one reason that he was able to kind of understand the positions of both sides and later on emerges as a figure of reconciliation between North and South, although that turned out to have very troubled history.
Yeah, another area where he straddled the North and the South was in his personal life. It was an interesting fact that I didn't know. Kind of came as a surprise to me that while he himself came from a strict Methodist abolitionist background, he married into a rich slaveholding family. I have to imagine that must have caused some friction in his home life.
Absolutely. I mean, poor Grant was caught on the one hand between his overbearing abolitionist father and his equally overbearing slave-owning father-in-law. In fact, you know, the Grants and his in-laws, the Dents, really were like the Hatfields and the McCoys. The Grants were so horrified by their Ulysses marrying into a slave-owning family that when Grant marries Julia Dent in St. Louis in 1848, the entire Grant family boycotts the wedding, and they never really accepted Julia. And his father-in-law, Colonel Dent, and the colonel was purely honorific. Colonel Dent said when the war broke out and Ulysses went with the Union side, he said, "If my worthless son-in-law ever sets foot on my land, I'll shoot him like a rabbit." And you thought you had a difficult father-in-law.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because he was kind of seen as somewhat worthless throughout most of his life. Particularly prior to the war, he kind of went from failure to failure as a businessman. And, you know, even earlier on, as during his career at West Point, was he a particularly ambitious or promising student?
No, you know, I keep saying to people that this is a story completely unlike any that I've ever written. Because when I was writing about J.P. Morgan or John D. Rockefeller, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, I felt as I was researching the story that even in their adolescence, they were built for success. They had fire in the belly and they had this drive and ambition that guaranteed that they were going to do something amazing. Ulysses S. Grant had no such big dreams. He graduated in the middle of his class at West Point. In fact, when he graduates from West Point, the extent of his ambition, he wants to return to the academy as an assistant math professor, not a full math professor, but as an assistant math professor.
Two.
And then what happens, so he ends up going into the regular army, 1854. He's drummed out of the army because of a drinking episode. He then tries farming in St. Louis. He's a failure. He ends up selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis. 1857, he's so poor that he has to pawn his watch in order to buy Christmas presents for his wife and children. And then in the greatest coming down of all, 1860, so we're just a year before the Civil War, he has to go to his father, hat in hand, and ask for a job as a clerk in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois, where he goes to work as a clerk junior to his two younger brothers. Ulysses Grant was 38 years old and married with four children. So I don't know that anyone who has ever served as president in our country has hit bottom as many times in life as Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah, I guess it's fair to say that prior to the Civil War, no one would have bet on Ulysses Grant to lead a million-man army, much less be president.
No, in fact, it's interesting because during those terrible years in St. Louis, Julia Dent Grant always had this implicit faith in her husband's greatness. You know, and when he's selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis to survive, Julia has a dream that one day her Ulysses would be president of the United States. And when she told it to friends and family members, they all laughed. It seemed like the height of lunacy to imagine that this man who was just desperately trying to survive would someday be president of the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Grant goes into the Civil War with some military experience. He's not a totally green. He has some under his belt, but I suppose he's nothing terribly special at the outset. Yet he skyrockets through the ranks at a record speed. How did this up-to-now unremarkable man manage such a meteoric rise?
Well, he had all of that information from West Point stored in his mind. He also had served with great distinction in the Mexican War, particularly he was a quartermaster. So he had the experience of logistics. He understood kind of the bureaucratic operation of a large army moving over great distances, which would be very important in the Civil War. And the speed with which he rises is astonishing. Remember, there was an acute shortage of trained officers on both sides when the Civil War broke out. So 2 months after the war breaks out, he's a colonel. 4 months later, he's a brigadier general. 10 months later, he's a major general. Of course, by the end of the war, he's general-in-chief, and he has a million soldiers under his command. And that was the mightiest military machine ever created in American history up until that point. So he'd be hard-pressed. I don't even think Alexander Hamilton's life was, you know, quite as improbable as this one.
Now, what did Lincoln see in Grant?
You know, what Lincoln saw in Grant, after Vicksburg fell in 1863, Lincoln, who loved Grant, said, and he'd never actually seen Grant face-to-face at that point. After the fall of Vicksburg, Lincoln said, you know, Grant is my man until the end of the war, and I am, you know, Grant's man. Lincoln felt that he had had in the East a series of whining, procrastinating generals who always hesitated to attack. If they attacked and were defeated, they blamed Lincoln for the loss. They were always arguing, you know, that they didn't have enough men. Grant was very self-sufficient. He was very much a self-starter. And as Lee was defeating one Union general after another in Virginia, in the Eastern theater of the war, Grant was winning one battle after the Western, you know, history of the Civil War is very, very different. You know, it's funny because if you read a history of the Civil War that focuses on Virginia, it seems like the South is winning the entire war. Then suddenly, for some reason, they lose at the end. But actually, if you start reading about what Grant was doing in the West, particularly with the fall of Vicksburg and the control of the Mississippi falls to the Union Army, it bisects the Confederacy, and a lot of the kind of horses and supplies of the Confederacy came from west of the Mississippi. So it's kind of a major step in beginning to starve out the Confederate Army. And even when Grant is facing Lee, Lee at Richmond and Petersburg is being supplied by five railroads and a canal, and Grant systematically cuts off his access to all five of those railroads and canals. Again, he was a former quartermaster who understood the importance of supplies.
And it's interesting you point that out because it seems to me that credit for winning the Civil War is often given to just the sheer numbers of the Union Army or the industrialized North and the railroad network, almost anything except Grant. Is he given credit. It seems that he's thought of kind of as an afterthought or a blunt instrument more than a tactician. Does he deserve more respect as a strategist?
You know, absolutely. You know, those people who say, well, of course Grant won because he had, you know, superior manpower. The population of the North was much larger, and he had the manufacturing base of the North behind it. But that begs the question of why, before Grant goes to Virginia in 1864 to directly face Lee, the North and the Army of the Potomac had had Irvin McDowell and George McClellan, John Pope, Ambrose Burnside, Joe Hooker, George Gordon Meade, all of these generals who had preceded Grant, who had the same advantage in terms of the Northern, you know, population and manufacturing power were not able to defeat Lee. But as soon as Grant comes along, he can. So there was clearly something going on other than, you know, whatever natural advantages the North had.
Is there a particular victory that best makes the case for Grant the strategist?
You know, the one I spoke to, you know, different military people as I was writing the book. And one, the one that is really enshrined in the Army manual in training at West Point seems to be Vicksburg, where, you know, Grant, Vicksburg seemed to be this impregnable fortress, fortification that went on for 7 miles along the Mississippi. And, you know, Grant has his gunboats, you know, run the Mississippi past those guns. He then transfers a massive army onto the east side of the river where the ground was, you know, higher and drier. And then in a five-week period, you know, wins this electrifying, you know, series of five victories and then lays siege to Vicksburg. I know that Vicksburg and Chattanooga were Grant's two favorites that he felt were kind of the model of what he could do as a general.
What did he think of Robert E. Lee?
That's a complicated question. He respected him. Interestingly enough, when asked after the war who was the greatest general, he said Joseph Johnston, which was funny, but not as funny as Lee being asked after the war who was the greatest general on the Union side. And he said George McClellan, who had been a disaster. So I think that there was certainly a kind of a competitive thing going on. Grant felt that Lee was a very good general, but overrated. He had a wonderful line. He said, Robert E. Lee was a man who needed sunshine. And he felt that in the South that there was greater political unity and that Lee had had this, you know, uncritical adoration and support. Grant felt with the so-called, you know, copperhead element in the North, in other words, you know, the people who had pro-Southern sympathies or were against the war, he felt that he was, you know, facing a much more complicated and divided, you know, North as a general. But I thought the best line, William Tecumseh Sherman, comparing Grant and Lee, said, Grant's strategy, using the railroads and the telegraph, Grant's strategy embraced a continent, Lee's a small state. And I think that that kind of shows, I think that Grant was the bigger strategic thinker. They were both kind of brilliant tacticians in individual battle, and Lee was quite extraordinary in that. But I think that Grant was the one who had this sweeping overall plan for winning the war.
Now, how significant was Grant's handling of Lee's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse in terms of how the South perceived the Union and shaping that relationship after the war?
Well, you know, his handling of it was exemplary in terms of its fairness. At Appomattox, Grant said that the defeated Confederate soldiers could keep their horses and mules, which was no small thing. They were starving. He gave them all 25,000 rations. He allowed the Confederate officers to keep their sidearms. And I think the most important thing was that he refused to gloat. He refused to allow his men to celebrate Lee's surrender.
Huh. And a couple of spiking the football.
Yeah, you know, a couple of interesting stories about this. Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy. After the Confederacy fell, Grant's wife Julia said, "You should really go into Richmond, you know, the conquering hero." And Grant said to her, "Julia, don't you realize how bitter defeat is for these people, and I don't want to rub it in." So interestingly, Ulysses S. Grant never went to Richmond after the fall of Richmond. Of course, he was pursuing Lee, who was fleeing west. The other story that I find fascinating and admirable is that when there was a proposal to hang in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol a historical painting showing Lee surrendering to Grant, he said no. He said that would simply humiliate the South. And I think that because he had experienced so much failure in his own life, I think that he understood the psychology of defeated people better than any other general.
That is so interesting.
Need to save face.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Now, 5 days after that, of course, Lincoln was assassinated. And it's funny because I think a lot of people forget that it was intended to be part of a larger conspiracy to decapitate the government. But the aspect of that I didn't know was that I guess Grant was targeted as well and probably would have died right alongside Lincoln in Ford's Theater if it hadn't been for a fight with his wife. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, the day that Abraham and Mary Lincoln were going to Ford's Theater, Grant was at the White House that afternoon. Lincoln said to him, you know, the people want to see the victorious president and the victorious general in public together. A few weeks earlier, the Lincolns had been in City Point, Virginia, where Grant had his headquarters, and Mary Lincoln, whose behavior was increasingly bizarre and unstable, had a terrible quarrel with Julia Dent Grant. And Julia said, I'm not going to the Ford's Theater if Mary Lincoln is going to be there. So the Grants decided they would flee town and go to Burlington, New Jersey. Now, two things happened that day which are very interesting. Number one, at lunch, Julia Grant was having lunch at Willard's Hotel around the corner from the White House. And during lunch, she was very unnerved by a pale man with dark hair who kept staring at her, these beady eyes, and playing with his soup spoon menacingly. And then what happened late in the afternoon, instead of going to Ford's Theater, they're taking a carriage to the train station to go to Burlington. And there is a pale man with dark hair on horseback who keeps galloping past their carriage. And then he circles around and he kind of swoops down and he looks in at them, glares in at them, in a way that Grant found very unnerving. And the following day, when Grant for the first time set eyes on a picture of John Wilkes Booth, he realized that the man who had been stalking Julia at lunch and then stalking them in the carriage on the way to the train station was John Wilkes Booth. It's an amazing story. Wow. And he was on the list. There was no question that Grant was on the list. Yeah.
Now, how did he react to Lincoln's assassination?
Oh, you know, there's a very touching image of him when Lincoln's body was lying in state, I think in the East Room of the White House, of Grant standing there, you know, alone near the casket, convulsed with tears, you know, his body shaking. Grant said that Lincoln was incontestably the greatest man he'd ever met. And they had a very touching relationship that I think really went beyond just that Lincoln came to trust Grant more than any other general. You know, they were kind of both Westerners, rather kind of simple, you know, Midwestern backgrounds. I think that they felt a kinship with each other. And Lincoln treated Grant with great affection. In fact, some of his comments, he found something amusing about Grant. He said to one of his secretaries after he met Grant in person, he said, he's the quietest little fellow you ever saw. He said a couple of times, he's been in my office for a minute or two before I even realized he was there. I mean, there's kind of real affection, you know, in that comment about it. And I think that Lincoln had a profound impact on Grant. And I think that, you know, Lincoln's agenda for the war, first preserving the Union and then freeing the slaves and conferring citizenship on them, you know, that agenda really becomes Grant's agenda for the rest of his life. And then Lincoln is assassinated, and Grant never expressed it this way, but I think that he really feels that he has taken on his shoulder, you know, the mantle of Abraham Lincoln, always honored him, always spoke reverently about him.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with author and historian Ron Chernow when we come back in just a minute. Folks, the most successful business owners I know are people who enjoy what they're doing. Whatever their thing is, they love it. But here's what they don't love. When they have to stop doing what makes them money to handle something that doesn't. Especially when it comes to email. And that's one reason AppRiver shines. AppRiver keeps your inbox free from spam and viruses, so you don't have to worry about all that junk cluttering up your day. If you're running your own email servers, protect them with AppRiver. And if you're tired of that headache, just sign up for Hosted Exchange or Office 365 and get your email from the cloud. Here's the best part. Call AppRiver anytime, night or day, and you'll talk to a real, live, U.S.-based company employee. Somebody who's trained to take care of your issue and lets you get back to doing what you love. Visit appriver.com/kick and try any of their services free for 30 days. That's appriver.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. Now, where did Grant originally see himself going after the war? Did he have any particular presidential ambitions?
No, but, you know, as throughout American history, you know, whether it's George Washington or Zachary Taylor or Dwight David Eisenhower, you know, victorious generals are immediately seen as potential, you know, presidential candidates. In fact, even Lincoln, you know, when he's running for re-election in 1864, keeps sending different emissaries to sound out Grant to make sure that Grant does not have presidential ambitions. And Lincoln makes an interesting statement: once a man gets that maggot in his brain, he can't get it out. And when word comes back from these emissaries that Grant feels has one and one, you know, goal alone, which is to defeat the Confederacy, Lincoln is enormously reassured, because he was very afraid that Grant was going to suddenly emerge as a political rival. Now, when the war ends, Grant is still general-in-chief. And so during that kind of four-year interregnum between the end of the war and the beginning of Grant's first term as president, he still is general-in-chief. And there's even a period where he's acting secretary of war. So that Grant really has like a continuous 16-year period of his life from 1861 to 1877, where he is centrally involved in everything going on in the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Yeah, and history is littered with military leaders who transitioned into politics, and maybe wasn't such an easy transition. How was it for Grant?
Well, I think that it was difficult. You know, during the Civil War, Grant's position, I think, was shot through with political calculations. I mean, for instance, he said to Lincoln, and Lincoln had never even thought of it, when it came to the defeat of Lee's army, Grant said to Lincoln that he wanted the Army of the Potomac to do it. The Army of the Tennessee out west had been winning all of these victories. He thought it was important in terms of post-war politics that the Army of the Potomac also be able to claim victory. And interestingly enough, Lincoln, who was a master politician, said to Grant, "Oh, gee, I never thought of it that way." So he was already becoming very astute politically. But I think that when he became president, by his own admission later on, he didn't realize in certain ways how unprepared he was. So he said that he tried to keep very much the same kind of model that he had had for his staff in wartime and try to transfer that into the White House. And it didn't work. So, for instance, Grant had gotten accustomed during the war being very secretive about his decisions. He was always afraid that his plans would be prematurely disclosed. And so when he picks his first cabinet, for instance, he doesn't consult anyone, you know, and makes some very significant mistakes, because he didn't yet realize that part of being president is to vet everything carefully, you know, to engage in a collaborative process. So there were a number of elementary lessons that he learned the hard way. But I argue in the book that Grant, as president, got a lot of small things wrong as president, but got the big ones right in terms of, you know, certain major policy issues coming out of the war.
His presidency was plagued with charges of corruption, incompetence, and graft. Is it right that blame for that is laid on his shoulders?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's not fair to the extent that these were not scandals in which he personally was implicated. He didn't condone them, and he prosecuted them vigorously for the most part. On the other hand, Grant had an incurably naive streak and tended to be blind to unscrupulous people. You know, he misplaced his trust, particularly he had an aide in the White House, Orville Babcock. Today we would say he was chief of staff, and Babcock was very involved in the scandal known as the Whiskey Ring. And I go into great detail in the book about these scandals. They are important. I don't want to minimize that. But I feel that the big story of his presidency is not the scandals, that the big story is Reconstruction and what he did to protect the 4 million former slaves who were now, 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, 14th Amendment gives them full citizenship right, and then the 15th Amendment gives them, at least black males, the right to vote.
Yeah, I'm curious about his thinking on race. Yeah. Was he a true believer in abolition, or was that a gradual evolution? Explain his thinking.
It was a gradual evolution. By Grant's own admission, going into the Civil War, he was not a hero on this issue. He did had received one slave as a gift before the Civil War in 1858, when he desperately could have used the money selling a slave. He actually went to the City Hall and freed the man, so that there wasn't an opposition to slavery. But I think when the war starts, Grant and all the Union generals have doubts in terms of whether blacks who were recently slaves, you know, could be capable soldiers. And there's a very important battle, Milliken's Bend. This is right around the time of Vicksburg Falls. Milliken's Bend on the Mississippi, where a black soldiers show not only that they can be very good soldiers, but enormously courageous, highly motivated soldiers. And it's saying something because the black soldiers, it had already been announced by the Confederacy that any black soldiers in the Union Army who were captured by the Confederates faced one of two possibilities. They either would be executed or they would be sold back into slavery. And so they had to put it mildly. They showed great courage, but were also very highly motivated to defeat the Confederates. So I think that this is just kind of honest of Grant actually observing the behavior of black soldiers. So he kind of gets religion on this issue in this sort of Grant way. It was a process that occurred very quietly.
Yeah, and this lingering resentment in the South that fueled the resurgence of the KKK that sort of the South will rise again mentality for really a century after the Civil War.
Absolutely.
Could Grant have possibly done anything more to avoid that, or was it inevitable?
You know, I think in retrospect, it looks inevitable. You know, he always said, I was more than ready to meet the South halfway. And I think that this would have happened had Lincoln lived, too. The war had emancipated the slaves. The 14th and 15th Amendment had given them, you know, full citizenship rights, including voting. Many of the Southern states had very large black populations. In fact, in South Carolina and Mississippi, blacks constituted the majority of the population. And the white South, which had been accustomed to white supremacy, was not going to allow blacks to have that role. And, you know, during Reconstruction, we had 600 blacks in Southern legislatures. We had 14 black congressmen and two black senators. But there were, you know, the Klan spread like wildfire to every Southern state. They murdered thousands of blacks. And the point of that was really to terrorize the black community into not exercising the right to vote. And there was no Southern jury that would convict a member of the Klan. So these were crimes that went unprosecuted until Grant launched this crusade against the Klan.
Well, these days we're living in such divisive times, maybe not as divisive as back then.
Yeah.
But are there lessons to be drawn from Grant and how we can unite people from opposite sides of the political spectrum, people who far too often see each other as the enemy and may believe that their differences are completely irreconcilable?
Well, I think, you know, I've been following very closely this whole controversy about the Confederate monuments. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when you strip away a lot of the political rhetoric, at the base of it is that we're at war with ourselves because there are two different narratives out there. They're kind of two different stories of what happened during the Civil War. So, you know, what I'm hoping with the monuments is that we can use this as a teachable moment, you know, remove those Confederate monuments, put them in historical societies, begin to teach people about the Civil War and Reconstruction. Because I, you know, I did an informal poll, my friends in New York who grew up in the South, just asking how, you know, Civil War and Reconstruction were taught. And there were kind of a lot of differences, but two consistent things. One, they were all taught that the Civil War was about states' rights, but every historian knows it was about slavery, and there was no controversy at the time about that. And then they were all taught about that Reconstruction was a complete fiasco of corrupt carpetbag politicians and illiterate black legislators. And there's been a major rethinking of Reconstruction the last generation or two. So most historians now would see it as a glorious, if ultimately doomed, attempt to create a biracial society in the United States. And so I really think that we have to kind of come to agreement in terms of what happened, because as long as we're walking around, you know, two different stories in our head, then we can't really find common ground on this. And the South, not everyone in the South, and I have found that a lot of young Southerners are not as attached to a lot of these Confederate symbols, you know, as their grandparents or great grandparents must have been. So I'm always trying to be helpful.
the states' rights argument always bugged me, and I got into it with people after the Confederate flag controversy. About a year or two ago, people would make this argument: it's about states' rights, about the Southern economy. And I'm like, well, yeah, states' rights to have slaves, you know, an economy entirely dependent on slave labor.
It was a figment.
I mean, is there any legitimate argument to be made that the war wasn't entirely about slavery?
Well, you know, right after the Confederacy was formed in early 1861, Alexander Stevens, who was the vice president of the Confederate States of America, gave a speech in which he said that the cornerstone of the Confederacy was the idea that the black man was inferior, that slavery was the black's mm-hmm. natural state. And he said this is the first government founded on that great principle. So if you look at all the secession conventions of the 11 states that seceded, it was all about slavery. They wrote a constitution that was based on the American Constitution, except for the provisions that guaranteed the future of slavery. So there's really not any argument mm-hmm. among historians, but this folklore in the South is very, very persistent. And then I always say to people, you know, who present me with the states' rights argument, historians now believe that 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War. And I just say to them, you really think that 750,000 people sacrificed their lives for the sake of states' rights? I know a lot of people now who feel very strongly about that, but I'm not aware that they're willing to lay down their lives for that principle. Yeah. And, of course, the states' rights, as you say. Why was there such an emphasis on states' rights? Because they felt that federal intervention was interfering with the peculiar institution of slavery.
Right. And I guess the idea that it was all about states' rights kind of came around alongside the resurgence of, KKK in what, the 1920s or the turn of the century or earlier than that?
Because right after the Civil War, you know, a group of writers included many Confederate generals. It was called the Lost Cause School. Mm-hmm. Essentially began to romanticize and mythologize the war. And part of that was that I guess it was no longer fashionable to defend slavery. So they said, you know, that the war was about states' rights. You know, and that kind of romanticized view of the South was very influential, not only in the South, but in the North. I find it remarkable, given the fact that the North won the Civil War, that to this day the most famous Hollywood movie about the Civil War is Gone with the Wind, which, you know, has happy slaves, you know, singing in the fields. And this was very much a view that was propagated in the years after the Civil War by the so-called Lost Cause writers.
Yeah. And along similar lines, a couple of months ago, I had Ken Burns on, and I asked him about the Confederate statues issue, and he said, look at when the statues were erected. If they were erected during the Reconstruction or perhaps during the 1950s, then that shows that the motives behind the statue, the purpose of the statue, was racist, as opposed to honoring the dead or something like that.
Yeah, because the statue started going up around 1875. So in other words, towards the end of Grant's second term as president, at a time when not only was the White South violently opposed to Reconstruction, but even support within his own Republican Party in the North had begun to wane. And so as those statues went up, it was a statement of defiance about Reconstruction and really a reassertion of white supremacy. So Ken is really right. These were not neutral statues by some history buff saying, wouldn't it be nice, to commemorate Robert E. Lee, that there was a big political agenda. And if you read about this, there's a wonderful book by David Blight called Race and Reunion. You know, it describes the ceremonies in a lot of the southern states as these statues went up, gigantic crowds and kind of fiery Lost Cause speeches. Now the statue might just be standing on a street corner in front of a courthouse. And so people don't understand the particular historical context in which they were created and why they were created. And there was sort of a big political agenda. So Ken Burns is absolutely right.
Going back to Grant, after his presidency, he found himself in desperate financial straits. How did that happen?
Well, it turned out that Grant had formed a partnership with a young man named Ferdinand Ward, lionized as the young Napoleon of finance. And it turned out that Grant invested his life savings with Ferdinand Ward. Ward turned out to be the Bernie Madoff of his day. The whole thing was a big Ponzi scheme. And so Ulysses S. Grant, who imagined that he was a multimillionaire, woke up one day to find out that he was worth exactly $80 and the whole thing was just a monstrous hoax. And at that point, I mean, the one thing that we owe to that, the one good side of that whole disaster was that Grant had sworn he would never write his memoirs, but around that time he's diagnosed with cancer of the throat and tongue. He's afraid that, when he dies of cancer, his wife is going to be left destitute. So with Mark Twain as his publisher, he writes the famous memoirs, which may have been the greatest bestseller of the 19th century, with the possible exception of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah, and it's sad and dramatic, his ending, because he's almost like Walter White on Breaking Bad, you know, racing to write his memoirs so he can take care of his family before he croaks.
Absolutely. And, you know, he, with that kind of granite determination of Grant's, he wills himself to stay alive.
Mm-hmm. And he's very painful.
Very painful. It's a gruesome way to die. And he puts down his pen, having completed the memoirs, just days before he died. So it was like he really was keeping himself alive to finish the memoirs. And his job done, he felt that he could let go.
Before that, was the idea of a presidential memoir frowned upon as maybe being beneath the office or in bad taste?
Well, just, you know, it was a military memoir because because, you know, it covers his childhood, the Mexican War, and then the Civil War. You know, there's no mention of his two-term presidency, so it doesn't pioneer. In that respect, but one way in which he did pioneer after he left the presidency, he took this more than 2-year round-the-world trip where he sets a new precedent for the post-presidency by engaging in freelance diplomacy. He arbitrates a dispute between Japan and China. So Grant continues to surprise throughout his life. It's one of the things I loved writing about him. You know, he was capable of growing. He was capable of changing and surprising us.
Yeah, and Mark Twain played a key role in encouraging him to write his memoir, and I think even in publishing it. I wonder, is there any evidence that maybe Mark Twain served as sort of his editor or maybe ghost wrote for Grant?
No, but you know, so many people, as I was writing the book, so many people asked me if Twain was the ghostwriter that I went down to the Library of Congress and I said to the archivist, I want to see the original manuscript. And I leafed through every page of the manuscript, almost all of it until the very end. Is in Grant's handwriting.
Really?
And Twain himself said that his contribution was kind of relatively trivial matters of grammar and punctuation. He made this lovely statement. He thought the memoir was a masterpiece. And he said, their style is flawless. No man can improve upon it. And I don't think that Grant could any more have imitated Mark Twain's style than Mark Twain could have imitated Ulysses S. Grant's style.
It's interesting because they have similar fates in some ways because, much like Grant, Mark Twain went into a great deal of debt through bad investments and then had to sing for his supper and dig himself out of that.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, because they sold the Grant memoirs sold in these kind of 2-volume box sets. They sold 300,000. At the time of the population of the country, it was only about 40 million. You know, Twain had set up this publishing company with his nephew, Charles Webster. They have a great commercial success with Grant's memoirs. And, you know, a lot of scholars feel that Twain got very sidetracked from his writing career, you know, by this business success. And then he had, you know, business failure. Yeah. So there are some interesting parallels between the two lives.
Now, I've never read it, but I'm sure you have. How does it hold up? Is it a typical self-serving, trying to frame history type of memoir, or does it have some value as a historical
record? No, I think it has tremendous value because, you know, Grant had not wanted to write his memoirs initially. He thought that there was something very kind of egotistical about that. And I think that what's so charming and engaging about the memoirs is they're very self-effacing. Grant admits fear. This is kind of my favorite passages towards the beginning. He's going into what he thinks will be his first combat experience in Missouri. And he and his men are approaching this hill. And Grant said his heart rose up into his throat. He was so terrified. And then they get to the top of the hill and they look down. And the Confederates have fled in expectation of Grant coming. And he said to himself, he said, I suddenly realized that they were as afraid of me as I was of them. And he said that that was an insight that he never forgot for the rest of the war. Not only think about your own fears and weaknesses, but he was able to sort of project himself into his enemy's fears and weaknesses. And it was a tremendous edge for him.
Now, your book, Alexander Hamilton, was, of course, later turned into the hit Broadway musical Hamilton. Do you think that you can picture U.S. Grant kicking up his heels and breaking into song?
No, I think it's safe to say that that Grant's life does not move to a hip-hop beat, but I think that it certainly is as dramatic a story, and I have hopes that it will be a fine feature film, if I had to predict.
Really?
When
who
I
would
come
you
back
cast?
Next time. I don't know whom I would have. That's a more difficult question, but I know that It will not be a Broadway musical.
It's funny. I think a few years back, I was in some meetings with Richard Dreyfuss. And I feel like at one point or another, there was an A&E movie that he was attached to, probably 10 years
Richard,
ago or something.
I've met him a couple of times.
And he loves history.
He's an enormous student of history. So at a certain age, he's now would be a little too old to play Grant. But at a certain time, he actually would have been, I think, quite interesting because, you know, Richard is rather short. Grant was somewhat short. Richard, you know, missed his chance. Maybe he had it. I didn't see that.
No, it was never made, I don't think. Okay. But, well, that's a movie I'll pay to see. Once again, Ron Chernow's epic biography, Grant, is available in bookstores on Amazon and Audible right now. Ron, thanks for joining me.
Oh, this has been a great pleasure. Wonderful interview. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to Ron Chernow for coming on the podcast. Order his epic biography, Grant, on Amazon. Or download the audio version at audible.com. Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Imagine if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front. That way you could try day trading the markets without worrying about the risk. Well, luckily you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Also, if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. And please take a moment to take our listener survey at podsurvey.com/kick so we can get to know who's listening, and it's also helpful with our advertisers. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.